The Balaturim is certainly one of my favorite commentators. Everyone should have a favorite commentator, you know? Like, I'm a great student of the whole discourse of Parshanut, and I feel like it is, you know, everyone, if someone asks you at a cocktail party, so who's your favorite Torah commentator? You know, I don't know. Like, I don't know who you would say. Anyone got an answer? Anyone have a favorite Torah commentator? The Kliyakar, good answer. That's a great answer. Yeah, it's good to have one that's like in Mikrot Gedolot, but not like Rashi. Like it's like Rashi's too obvious. Yeah, yeah. The what? Kasudo. Okay, good. Modern commentary. Yeah. Others. Svat Emet. One of the great Hasidic commentators. Bravanel. Sforno. All right. See where this is the right group. All right. So you probably, if you can name names like this, have seen the Balaturim and have some feel for the kind of commentary that we find in the Baal HaTurim. It is in some ways a little bit like Rashi on steroids. That is to say, it is drawing from the world of Midrash, but Rashi presents himself as a Pashtan, like, Ani lo bati ela letet pshuto shel mikra, Rashi says a couple of times. I'm just here to give the pshat, which seems so weird when we read Rashi's commentary because he's often introducing all kinds of wild midrashic images. But we have to then understand that I guess what Rashi means is, yes, but this is the midrashic image that best suits the verse. It solves whatever problem I'm trying to solve in the verse. The midrash deployed as a kind of an assist to the pshat. The Balaturim is not at all constrained in that way, and we'll see that he's willing to play around with the pshat of the verse on a much grander scale than even Rashi. Let's just say, by way of introduction, it's important to note to like place the Balaturim in time, and here I'll pass this around, and you'll see that he was a 14th century. A thinker, born in the 13th century, 14th century thinker, and that puts him at the end of the Middle Ages, which is significant in itself because the Middle Ages is a period dominated by this obsession with pshat, with all of the commentary. Rashi, who doesn't seem to us like such a pashtan, nevertheless introduces himself as a seeker of the pshat, and that was very, very fashionable in the discourse at the time. Let's get back to the text. And, you know, if I can make a kind of broad sweeping claim, I think there's a pendulum swing in general in the history of Parshanut, where, you know, the move back and forth between Midrash and Pshat, you can see from the first period, the Midrashic period, and then in the Middle Ages, a return to Pshat. And then at the end of the Middle Ages, you know, by the time you get to figures like the Kli Yakar, you have a kind of return to Drash again, and then in the Enlightenment again, a return to Pshat. So you could, like, that's one way of thinking about just, like, there's been too much focus on the precision of reading the words. Oh, no, there's too much wildness, and we have to get back to, like, really understanding the text. If that's so, then the Balaturim is sort of right at the end of a pshat period and the beginning of a drash phase. And once we get to the 15th, 16th century, we'll be once again among darshanim. That's one way to place the Balaturim. But maybe the easiest way to place him is to tell you that he was the son of the Rosh. The Rosh was a great halachic authority, German halachic authority in the 13th century. And with the Rosh, he moves from Germany to Spain. And I had a teacher, Dov Weiss, who would always say, this is a very critical thing to understand when looking at the tour, the son of the Rosh, which is that he had sort of an experience of a lot of Jewish practices and a lot of just Jewish cultures. And that maybe is part of how we can think of what the Balaturim is most known for and the reason we call him the Balaturim, which is that he is the composer of the Tur, or the Arba Turim, is one of the most important halachic works, collections that we have. The Shulchan Aruch is based on the Tur, the structure of the fourfold structure of the Tur, the Arba Turim, referring to the four columns on the breastplate of the Kohen. By the way, as an aside, it's called the Arba Turim, the columns on the breastplate of the Kohen. Why he chooses the breastplate of the Kohen? Well, probably because it's called Choshen Mishpat, which is one of the four columns. The name of one of the four columns is Choshen Mishpat. But the Tur, by naming his halachic work after the clothing of the high priest starts a trend, and then you can find lots of, you know, lots of halachic works after that, you know, the tzotar choshen and the levush, right? Like there's now a whole kind of shelf on the library of books named after the petil techelet, the all kinds of halachic works that draw their source from the clothing of the high priest. So that's interesting in itself. The tour is known then for that work mostly. And then the commentary of Rav Yosef Karo on that work, the Beit Yosef, and then the distillation of that, the Shulchan Aruch. So the Torah really becomes like someone that we encounter in rabbinical school when we're learning halacha. But of course, he also has this tiny little commentary. And I say tiny because his comments are often very, very brief. That's part of what's so delightful about them, is you can get a lot in just a few words. And it turns out that the commentary that we know isn't even the main commentary that the Tour wrote. That is to say, and we'll see it here in his introduction, the Tour wrote a commentary on the Torah that we have that is supposedly the less fanciful commentary on the Torah, although the truth is, like, once you start to look at them both, the distinction is not as sharp. But let's let the Tour introduce himself, and we'll look here at the introduction. And by the end of the introduction, we will understand what commentary we're looking at. He writes two commentaries, and we're going to be mostly interested in this second commentary. So it's like, you know, there's the Tour, the great halachic work that everybody knows the Tour for. Then there's a commentary on the Torah, which is like lesser known. And then there's this like little extra thing that he put on top of his commentary on the Torah that we actually think of as the Baal HaTurim, okay? Weirdly, when we refer to him in halacha, we often call him the Tur. It's Yaakov ben Asher. And when we refer to him on the Torah, we call him the Baal HaTurim. I'm not sure. Okay. But let's see. If you will you read a paragraph for me in English?
Yes. Behold, I have ventured to speak, though I possess no human understanding, nor the strength of a man. Neither do I have the words to compose a work, for I am more boorish than any man, and have not learned wisdom. I possess neither knowledge nor discernment, and I know nothing at all.
Okay, this is the guy I just described. It's like founding our whole halachic discourse. So false modesty, or is he really the humblest person on earth? Hine na ho'alti ledaber, ki lo binat adam li v'chayelim legever, gam ki lo milin lechaber, ki be'er anochi me'ish, v'lo lamadati chochma, v'ein bi dat u'mizima, v'lo iti yodea ad ma. Will you read the next paragraph?
Omnam zima la nafshi v'asri lecha kama, afi nistara mimeni v'ne'elma, ki hi melechet shemayim, v'chol dvarecha al
ofanim.
Nidreshet hi lekol shoel ba al yirechim ulekol asher yatala oznayim ki lo ma'abar leyam hi ulo b'shamayim achen kruva hi lekol asher yikarev aleha alev uvesvatayim.
However, my soul thirsts and my flesh yearns for it, even though it is hidden and concealed from me. I love this. For it is the work of heaven, and all its words are perfectly set. Like, I love it because it sounds like someone saying, like, I'm such a simpleton, but I just want to study Torah, although it's the Tour, like, right. But okay. It can be interpreted by all who inquire after it and by all who incline an ear to it, for it is not across the sea, and nor is it in the heavens. It is very near to all who approach it with the heart and the lips. Now, this is interesting. This is, like, what I mean. Beginning to introduce himself as not just a Pashtun, but someone who is bringing the Torah in its most accessible form to you. That seems to be the project at hand here. Did I already see a hand? No.
I was more just like a looker. I don't know. I find that, like, I have no words, but it's in my mouth. It's in the heavens, but it's in my mouth.
Yeah. Well, don't worry, because all of this is a setup, because, like, what he's seems to be presenting is, I'm going to give the most simple commentary ever, and then soon we're going to see that his is going to be one of the weirdest, most intricate commentaries ever, but he'll get there. Yes, Mark.
First of all, he starts with, I have no knowledge, In the second paragraph, he's comparing himself to the Torah. The Torah is what's not over the sea.
It's, I am not a wise person. I don't have particular knowledge or skill in this, but the Torah itself should be accessible. It's not far from us.
I see this. He's saying, I'm like the Torah.
I am accessible. It should be accessible. I am accessible. I am. Yeah. Okay. Now, here he describes what we refer to now as the Tur HaAruch, the longer commentary of the Torah, And he cites as his great inspiration Nachmanides, the Ramban, another good favorite Torah commentator to have. But look at what he says about the Ramban and how he distinguishes himself. You want to read this, my intent?
Sure. My intent in writing this is only because the words of the rabbi, which he just, and he just refers to him.
Yeah, earlier he had called them the Ramban, but it's, yeah, Harav.
Rav, right? Were too wondrous for me, and his statements are impenetrable. So I said to myself, I shall glean from them the pshat matters and leave aside the stumim, the sealed matters, for my soul has not entered into a secret council. I do this so that it will be easier for me to study. And if I found a pshat or an explanation from another place, I joined them to his words. So these were just a few things.
It's like, it's also, as you say, sir, I was like, I shouldn't have even written this. This is, what am I even doing? Forget about it. But he actually is saying something significant here, right? Which is that he admires the masterpiece commentary of the Ramban, but the Ramban brings, you know, Derech Chochmah, brings Kabbalah, brings all kinds of, like, philosophy, brings, like, a whole worldview into his commentary. I admire the commentary of the Ramban. Ve'en kavanati b'zeh rak kiyan nifle'u mimeni divrei harav, ve'hem stumim amarim. Elekta mehem hadvarim hapshutim, va'ashir hastumim, ki besodo lo ba nafshi. And this is interesting. Now, I said, I'm just going to do a simpler version of the Ramban. And then this line is just so interesting to me. Leman heyot nekal be'enai lilmod. It's so that it could be easier for me to learn. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thought to write a commentary on the Torah to help you learn. It's like something to consider. Ve'im matzati pshat otam b'makom acher, chibarti imo. I added a few other little things. Okay, and then at the very end of this introduction, finally he gets to what's exciting, what will consume us as, you know, fans of Parshanut for the next generation. So do you want to read, I also saw fit, the last line there?
V'ra'iti od lichto b'tchilat seder, the seder me'at par pe'ot.
Yeah, like apata par pera'ot. Okay, I also saw fit, and here it is, at the beginning of every Torah portion, every sidra, a few appetizers. Mi gematriot, from gematria, and tamei hamisoret. Okay, we'll see both of those things appear. But now you're going to kind of get a sense, oh, this isn't pshat. I'm going to be interpreting the numerical value of the words. And by the way, gematriot in Avot, right, are called parparota chochma, right? Like appetizers to wisdom. So this is like a little, and it's going to be at the beginning of the parsha, a few little things. This is what's known as the kitzer balaturim, the short balaturim. But this is the one we study. Although that's not entirely true. And I must say that once you start to read the tour, you realize like some of that style bleeds from one section to another, and there are even printings that kind of combine them. So if you'll pardon the sloppiness, we're not going to distinguish. I'm going to go back and forth between the Tur HaAruch and the Kitzer Balaturim. We're going to look at various observations that come, because it turns out it's not so clear a distinction of Pshat and Par Peraot. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm just, to point of clarification, are we studying the Torah right now? Is this from the Torah? Or is this a Torah commentary by Baal Torah?
Good. That's the right question, and it's the latter. The Torah is the fourfold halachic work, the Arba Turim. We refer to that as the Torah.
Right.
And this is by the same guy, Rav Yaakov ben Asher, who was the Baal HaTurim, the one who wrote the tour, but he also wrote a commentary on the tour.
What is it called? Is there a name for it?
Yeah, it's a good question. There isn't a name for the commentary of the Bala. Yeah, at least as far as I know.
Okay.
I don't know if he put it like but we always call it the Kitzer Balaturim or the Tur HaAruch. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, just the last thing there, in order to draw out the heart. So that's a good framing, you know, what is all of this wildness that we will soon encounter after he made such a strong claim that, you know, he really just wants to be simple and clarify everything simply. Well, this is like to draw out the heart. I mean, like, I'm translating that today as like for fun, you know, to like enjoy ourselves. Draw out the heart is probably a deeper phrase than that, but there's something nice at the end. He's like, just added a few little things, and then this is becomes what he's known for. Yeah.
It seems to me that it's not unusual that a commentator would attach his commentary to a well-known commentator.
Mm, that's right.
Maybe so that the sale of the books will go better.
Right.
Or, I mean, there could be other reasons, but it seems that that's happened under... Other people did that too.
Yeah.
Didn't Nachmanides do that also? In the sense that, you know, you read him and every so often
he's like... Freedom of Rush.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there is a proliferation of super commentaries on Rashi in the 16th century. And so it becomes fashionable to not write a commentary on the Torah, but write a commentary on Rashi's commentary on the Torah. The Maharal, who I was just talking about in the last class, wrote his first work is the Gur Arya. Never wrote a commentary on the Torah for all of his voluminous writing. He writes a commentary on Rashi, and this seems like a similar move to attach yourself to a pre-existing commentary, which is to say that the genre of Parshanut has sort of been, in some ways, set by the end of the golden age of the Middle Ages, and now people are thinking of the classics like Nachmanides and like Rashi and like the Ibn Ezra and writing commentaries on them or in conversation with them. Okay, what I want to do just to orient us, because this is highlights and I'm going to be showing you, oh, this is cool and then this is cool. What I want to do to just kind of get us into the discourse is to read his first comment on Bereshit. And as you'll soon see, and we're going to read it quickly, I want it to kind of wash over us because I just want you to get a feel for what kind of commentary we will encounter in the Baal HaTurim. So there's a lot here, but let's just do this fast. We'll just read one at a time on the second page. Bereshit bara Elokim et haShamayim v'et haAretz. That's a good verse to start with, right? Okay, so I'm going to read the Hebrew, and then I'm going to ask just, we're going to go fast. And like I said, let it wash over you, but keep your eye out for what kinds of interpretations are we seeing here. We'll try to make a list of it, okay? So, how do we interpret Bereshit bara Elokim et haShamayim v'et haAretz? Yesh b'midrash, Bereshit Rabbah, shilakach patach babet v'lo ba'alef. Lefi shebabet hi lashon bracha, v'alef lashon arura. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu eftach babet v'lashon bracha v'levai shiyuchal litkayem.
There's a midrash in Bereshit Rabbah that the reason why the Torah opened with a bet and not with an aleph is because the bet has a connotation of blessing, like bracha, and aleph has a connotation of cursing. The Holy Blessed One said, I will open with a bet with the language of blessing, and would that it should be fulfilled.
Davar acher, al shem shnei olamot shebara, haolam hazeh v'olam haba. And I'll just note while we're pausing, this davar acher is an interesting move. Like, that's a midrashic move. Like, obviously, he's just quoted from, not obviously, but he's quoted from a midrash. This is not his idea. But then to say, to give that, as Rashi might do, but then to say davar acher, which is not unheard of in other commentaries, but look at how he employs it, almost like he is writing a midrash. So davar acher Hashem shnei olamot shebara, olam hazeh v'olam haba. Would you give us the English for that?
Another possibility, because the two worlds that were created, this world and the world to come.
Davar acher al shem shtei torot, Torah shebichtav v'Torah shebal peh, lelamdecha shebizchut haTorah v'lomdeha nivra olam.
Another possibility, because of the two Torahs, the written Torah and the oral Torah, to teach you that the world was created in the merit of the Torah and its learners.
So these are his original writings?
No. Let me just say this now, because since you ask. Part of what will become complicated as we move further is discerning what he is quoting and what he is innovating. And that becomes a blurry line here in the Baal HaTurim. But these seem like very classic midrashic extractions here. Okay, notice it doesn't say davar acher. Otiot beit rosh. Kolomar beit hamikdash rishon. Shenemar kisei kavod marom mirashon makom mikdashenu.
Bereshit has the same letters as Beit Rosh, first house, meaning the first temple, as it says in Jeremiah, an honorable throne exalted from the beginning, the place of our temple.
Davar acher, otiot aleph betishrei, Nivra Ha'olam.
Another possibility. The same letters as Aleph B'Tishrei, which was when the world was created.
Davar Acher, Otiot Barashtei, Shabarashtei Torot.
Another possibility, the same letters as Barashtei created two, because God created two Torahs.
Davar Acher, Otiot Yarei Shabbat, Lomar Lecha Shebezchut Shabbat Nivra Ha'olam.
Another possibility, the same letters as Yarei Shabbat, of the Sabbath, to tell you that the world was created in the merit of the Sabbath.
Davar Acher, Otiot Brit Eish, Shebezchut HaBrit, Shehi Hamila, Uvezchut HaEish, Shehi HaTorah, Nitzulin Midina Shel Gehenem.
Another possibility, the same Hebrew letters as Brit Eish, Covenant of Fire, that in the merit of covenant, which is circumcision, in the merit of fire, which is the Torah, we will be saved from the judgment of Gehenna.
Davar Acher, Barata Yesh, Shebara Yud Shim Olamot Lechol Tzadik.
Another interpretation, the same Hebrew letters as Briat Yesh.
Yeah, it's not Briat, it's Barata Yesh.
Barata Yesh, creation of something. For 310 worlds were created for every righteous individual.
Okay, and we're don't worry, we're getting towards the end here, but I want you to hear all of this. Bereshit bara, bigamatria, barosh hashana nivra.
Bereshit bara has the gematria of on rosh hashana, parentheses, the world was created.
Davar acher, bereshit, bigamatria, batorah yatzar. Shebishvil haTorah nikret reshit nivra haolam.
Another possibility, bereshit has the gematria of formed with me the Torah, because the world was created because of the Torah, which is called reshit.
Davar acher bigmatria shesh sdarim.
Another possibility, the gematria of six orders of the Mishnah.
Davar acher bigmatria Yisrael bachar ba'amim.
Another possibility, the gematria of Israel is chosen among the nations, and also the gematria of formed with 613, for God created the world for the sake of Israel, keeping the 613 commandments.
Yeah, I forgot to read that whole part. Bigmatria taryag yatzar. Shebara olam bishvil Yisrael sheikaimu tayag mitzvot. Bereshit, notrikon bara rikia aretz v'shamayim yam tahomot.
Come on, we all knew this. Bereshit's an acronym. Created, firmament, land, heaven, sea, abyss.
Davar acher, bereshit, davar acher bereshit, bereshona ra'a Elohim sheyakablu Yisrael Torah.
Another possibility, it stands for from the beginning. Foresaw God that they would accept Israel the Torah.
Okay. Bereshit bara Elohim sofei tevot emet. Did you know that? That's cool. Sofei tevot emet. Milamet shebara kadosh baruch hu olam be'emet. Kmo she'ne'emar, rosh devarcha emet.
Bereshit bara Elohim, the ending letters from emet, truth, which is that the Holy Blessed One created the world with truth.
Okay, all right. And I hear some people already kind of rolling their eyes. I get it. But okay, let's...
The guy's got too much time on his hands.
Okay, all right, good. So we have some reactions.
My teachers used to say about Rambam, like, he never had to drive carpool.
Okay, so let's first just sort of like try... This is his opening gambit here, you know, like, Davar Acher, Davar Acher, Davar Acher, Davar Acher. Note, though, that there are like... The Davar Achers come as extra... versions of the same method, right? The like these are extra possibilities for gematria or for Rosh Tevot. So let's just name. So what are some of the moves that we saw him make? What kinds of interpretation are we being told right at the outset that we should associate with the commentary or the appetizer commentary, the Bala Turim? What do you see here?
Anagrams.
Anagrams, good. Right, taking a word and mixing up the letters. What else?
Acronyms.
Acronyms, good. Acronyms, or what we call in Parshanut, or just Torah discourse in general, Roshe Tevot.
Right. And then just...
Doesn't he also call that Notarikon?
Notarikon, true. Yes, Notarikon. That's what he calls here, Notarikon. I looked that up once. Does anyone know what that means? I forget exactly what that means. It's a Greek word.
A notation
from this. Yeah. Okay, good.
It's a Greek word, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm calling it Roshe Tevot, though you're right. He called it Notrikon, or Notarikon maybe. But I'm thinking of Roshe Tevot because there was another one at the end. What was the last thing? Sofei Tevot, which you don't usually see. Sofei Tevot. The last, you know, last letter acronym. Okay. What else? Did we see anything else?
It's more like a mnemonic than an acronym, right? Like, he's not saying this is one thing. He's, like, saying this is a way of remembering all these different...
Okay, okay. So now this is the second level question, which is, like... You know, what are these for? What are these meant? What is he telling us here? And Sarah Beth speculates that what he's saying is, well, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but like, this is a way of associating an idea with Bereshit.
Right.
This is a helpful way to every time you read the word Bereshit, just know that God, you know, Bereshona Ra'ah, God saw it from the beginning that we would accept the Torah. Like, it's a way of attaching ideas to the verse. That's one reading, though. Like, it's also possible that he's saying something quite grand here, which is that the Torah, it is possible to read the Torah in all these ways. So I don't know. Like, what do you think? Between, like, this is a fun mnemonic device, and, like, maybe I'm suggesting saying something about how we ought to read Torah. Can we really be this creative with our manipulation of the letters? So it's sort of, it's an open question in general, but it's also, it's, I think, an open question in how to read the Baal HaTurim. Any thoughts on that? On that question, yeah.
Maybe, it almost, it's like a parlor game.
Yeah.
Or a game. I know there's a game, I just don't know the
yeah.
title.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like you're sitting in a group of people, and it's like, okay, come up with as many blanks for this. Or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah, so that's, I'm not sure, and I don't want to like claim on behalf of the Baal HaTurim, but you do sometimes get the sense that he is doing it for fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, look what I can do. The man has clearly a savant-like mind for Torah. Like, this is just his side project after all. And maybe it's just fun for him to say, look what I can make up, look what I can make up, look what I can make up. On the other hand, I still want to hold in mind the possibility that he's saying something about the way Torah can be interpreted. Because as we're going to see, he gets more and more into, in deeper into his comment. So far, it's like, it does feel like a parlor game, like Bereshit, beginning, you know, like you're just doing it. But I want us to hold in mind the possibility that there's really like, a vision of Torah here, a method here. Yeah, in the back.
Well, from a spiritual point of view, it sounds like he's seeking connections.
Yeah.
As opposed to conniptions.
Good, good, good. Right. In other words, maybe it's possible, after all, maybe it's possible to read the Torah as a kind of a perfect assemblage of letters that is meant to be interconnected in all kinds of ways. And this, like, connection building is the work of the Parshan. And as a matter of fact, there is one famous Parshan who says that all of the Torah is just like various arranged names of God. And who is that? Nachmanides, the Ramban, his hero. So I wonder if there isn't a little more thinking about, like, no, there's a power, a mystical power to the Torah where it allows for this kind of interpretation. I just want to hold that possibility out there as well. Who else had a thought? Yeah.
This was feeling very New York Times spelling bee for me.
Yeah.
But in the good way of like, wow, this sort of like infinite creativity. I mean, but not infinite of like, could I possibly come up with all the combinations?
Yeah.
Like the creativity, the game, the playfulness of it. And also to your point, it's like on the one hand, yeah, I do feel like all of these, the expansiveness of what Rav Tali taught on the first night about Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is the Mayan Mitgaber.
Yeah.
There is a sort of like Mayan Mitgaber energy of this,
yeah.
The infinite ways that we could read and understand Torah. But I also wonder if it could have the opposite effect or the opposite feeling,
yeah.
Of like, well, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this, which is to say we couldn't possibly know.
Yeah.
Like it could also lead you towards in a I don't mean this as a negative theological claim, it's like we couldn't possibly understand.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of the negative version, although that's a version that you just gave. Like, it's how could you ever, like, it's infinite, where do I even start? But there's also, like, the danger here of, like, if we're to take this seriously as a method, maybe he's just having fun, but if we're to take it seriously as a method, then, you know, then the idea is anything that you can, come up with, then, you know, for, like, the letters of Bereshit, like, you could start coming up with bad messages. You could start coming. Has anyone ever been presented in their you know, yeshiva years with Bible codes. This is like, you know, when early on in my yeshiva time, they're like, show me how, like, you know, if you just add up the, you could like find 9/11, you can find all these things.
Retroactively predict the future.
Yeah, and it just, exactly right. And it's just like, they never tell you the day before 9/11, they always tell you the day after. But it's, it starts to feel a little bit like, oh yeah, just give me a calculator and I'll come up with a gematria for, you know, it's just like, there's something about this. So we may leave it in the realm of like he's having fun and wants us to have fun, or he may be suggesting something theologically bolder, but there are perils in that theological boldness. All right, let's take a couple more thoughts, Scott.
I read a book recently called Moonwalking with Einstein. And it's all those people that build these memory castles and they create mnemonics with images because it's easier to remember images than a long string of numbers like pi. So I also wanted to see he's creating imagery of firmament and land and heavens and seas. It's also, is he creating these memory palaces for himself to better associate?
Beautiful, beautiful. And that builds on what Sarah Beth was saying earlier. You want to add other thoughts?
Thinking of him as not the Baal term, but the Tor, right? Like, this is the man who puts, like, order into chaos.
Yeah.
And, like, he said in the opening, I'm creating this for my own learning, right? Yeah. You imagine you have this guy who's, like, an absolute master in synthesizing information in a way, and he's hearing ideas from all around, and he says to himself, I'm making a list, and I'm going to sit with all of them, and it's not a way of saying, like, there's one theology, but it's a way of taking ideas and creating order by putting them in, like, together.
Yeah, I love the way you're using that language. You're making a very strong case for your understanding of this, which is that it's a device to help me and to help me associate it, to build a memory palace for myself. But I will say that whether he's buying into the true interpretation of all these things or not, he does set the stage for others to really take. Like, one thing we didn't name up here, which is huge, which he mentions in his introduction, is gematriot. So now, Chazal use gematriot. Gematriot are nice, but like, they explode into this, you know, in the Kabbalistic period, they explode into this like sort of primary way of looking for the, talk about Bible code, secrets of the Torah, and the Baal HaTorim is really the one who lays the ground for, like, nobody gives gematria like the Baal HaTorim does. Yeah,
I think there's also a real tangible ritual learning happening here, right? Like when you learn things in high school, and I mean even today as adults, and then you have the opportunity to teach it, that's actually when you know it best.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like through this teaching moment,
right.
He's able to instill within himself, not just through a mind palace, but through like a tangible expression of what he's learned.
Right.
It's now becoming him.
Right. Look at all of the interpretations I've heard over the years. And I'm thinking again of like the guy who assembles like a whole halachic world for us, like someone who's been, I'll collect these things, like a collector, and now has it to present, you know.
Internalizing it in a different way than I would have if I was just, you know, writing a sermon.
Yeah. Good. Okay, this is a good start. Mark, what do you add?
Actually, a very serious thought. If you see the Torah as divine and designed to have all these meanings, it's not him playing, it's him teaching that it's intrinsically full of everything that you want.
Yeah. Yeah. That bolder theological position, I think, is intriguing as well. I can't help but feel like, even though he keeps framing this as a little bit like, you know, oh, you're so humble. Like, he keeps framing this as like, this is just extra, don't worry about it. But he's so obsessed with this stuff, like, one wonders how much credence he places into it. Okay, that's a good introduction. That is literally his introduction and first comment. Now I want to just let it, like, this is called highlights, although it looks like my title for every page is on the previous page, so you'll just see highlights at the bottom. But the next page, page 4, is, here are just some, like, I will admit that this is not my most well-designed class. This is like, oh, here's another cool thing from the Baal HaTorim. Like, some of that is happening here. But I want to give you some highlights that are just sort of, you know, wonderful appetizers from the Baal HaTorim. And then eventually we'll kind of get to the strangest places and begin to ask some provocative questions. But let's take a look at some of the other, we saw Roshei Tevot, Sofei Tevot, we saw Gematriot and anagrams even. Here's some other moves that the Baal HaTorim makes, and here's a particularly cool one on the sixth commandment, which will actually be significant here. So let's see, where are we in our reading? Lo Tirzach, Dibur Shishi, v'yesh bo vavotiyot, lomar lecha she'adam nivra b'yom ha'shishi.
Do not murder. This is the sixth commandment, and it contains six letters to tell you that human beings were created on the sixth day.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the sixth commandment, and it has six letters, and the human beings were created on the sixth day. Now, I see people shaking their heads. This is deep, though.
Yeah.
This is deep. Come on. Give it a moment. Give it a moment. This is like a profound thing that he's saying. Somebody speak it out to me. What's the message here, if there's a message?
Human beings were not just created, but are the piece of the world that destroys.
Yeah. Thou shalt not kill is a commandment that is about undoing the creation. Undoing the pinnacle of creation. Like, when we're told not to kill a human being, it's because God created a human being, and when you kill a human being, you undo God's creation. And
Dafka
the way...
on the sixth day.
Sorry?
Dafka on the sixth
day. Dafka on the sixth day. The way the Torah tethers that, makes that connection for you, is that the Torah wants you thinking six, six, six. What is it about six that this commandment is structured around, and why is it signaling 666 to us? Not 666, sorry. The number of the beast? No, because it wants you thinking of the sixth day of creation.
Wouldn't it be good if you said 6-7 here?
Yeah, okay. So again, I'm not going to do this every time, but again, I want to ask you a question I just asked up there, which is like, isn't he serious? Like, are we to take this? I actually, like I said, I think there's something quite profound in it. On the other hand, lots of other of the Ten Commandments, Lo Tinaf also has six letters, right? But it's not the sixth commandment. This is the sixth commandment. And it takes us back to the sixth day. I mean, don't you think that's good? I mean, that's a good connection.
That's a good trick.
Yeah, what do you think?
Do you have any thoughts on, like, everything that you just said that made it make a lot of sense was very lovely. Do you have any thoughts on, like, why does he not do that work for us?
Yeah.
The work that David just did.
David just made explicit. He could also have made explicit.
Right.
And yeah. Be like, I understand the profound thing that's happening.
Yeah, my experience of it, I'll just tell you experientially. I'd be interested to hear other people's thoughts on this. But I think, precisely, he wants to give you the marvelous connection, and then let you think about for a moment about, like, what are the implications here? I mean, after all of the... you know, Bereshit Torahs that we read, we didn't stop and think, like, what does he mean, Shesh Sedarim? Like, what? Bereshit refers to the six, you know, orders of the Mishnah? Well, but that's saying something, which is that, like, not just was Torah anticipated by the world, but by the beginning of the world, but the oral Torah was anticipated by God in the beginning of the world. You're left to make that sort of that second layer interpretation. Like, that's the answer I would give, is that he wants you, like, thinking about the reason I'm saying this is that I think it's the weirdness is part of the method. Like, it's he wants you thinking, like, what? The 666 day of creation? Oh. And I think he wants you doing that kind of work. So that's my answer. Other thoughts?
Maybe he's trying to channel the Ramban. There's a lot of places in Ramban he says, here's a comment, but you have to think about it. You won't get it right away.
Right. Right. In other words, there might be something larger in the discourse that plays into this mode of communication. Like, here's the first layer. Now you make the final connections. Maybe I'm imputing too much to it, but that's the way I look at it. Yeah, what do you think?
Unless if it's possible, that's like, it goes back to the, I'm making this in order for me to learn better. It's like, this isn't for us. This is for him.
Right.
It's his own shortcut for himself. Uh-huh. He understood what he meant by
it. In which case, right, back to the Sarah Best, like, mnemonic vision of this, in which case, yes, like, it would be for him to make this connection, but it also becomes that for me and for all of us. Like, now I'm never going to read the sixth commandment again, because I always think of it as, like, it's the undoing of the creation of the human being. Like, that's so cool. I have that now as a mnemonic device, and I'm carrying it with me. Like, there's just no way I would carry it with the same force unless I had, like, the 6666 little coding to get me there, so... Yeah.
Well, that was really helpful, actually, because I was like, well, how does he account for, like, the lack of comprehensiveness? Like, there's 10 commandments, there's 7 days of creation, okay, so this is the only one where, like,
right.
And there's others with 6 letters.
Right.
Why this one? Yeah. But actually, if it's just a way of being able to, like, yourself relate more, in a more focused way, mm-hmm. like, what does this Kamaban actually mean to me? Yeah. And how do I carry it in my own head?
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter what the other, like, how you might find other ways to account for it.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I think I appreciate this language that you're offering. And I just want to say, you know, this seems like we're talking about a very unique method that the Balaturim is bringing to us. But, you know, Rashi says on Yom HaShishi, you know, why is it HaShishi? Because it's HaShishi, the sixth of Sivan, that God is anticipating that the world will be given on the sixth of Sivan. That's the HaShishi, whereas earlier it had just been Yom HaMishi. And Lamar Lecha, Kol HaOlam, you know, Nitla'im Ve'omdim, waiting for the Jews to accept the Torah. So now, there's Rashi giving you, you know, a very kind of strange way of thinking, like, oh, the sixth day of the Torah is actually a reference to the sixth of a Babylonian month many years, you know, like... But so I'm just wondering now, as you're speaking all this out, like, should we also think of that as a mnemonic device? Like, is that also a way of affixing an idea to? So it's a bigger, it becomes a bigger way of framing Torah than just a Balaturim question. Yeah, yeah.
One of my professors in rabbinical school used to explain it like, you know, sometimes the way we read things, they understood each other in a way that we never could. Mm. So they were all part of, like, all these commentators and their level of knowledge. Sometimes they could just say something and everybody was able to associate what they meant.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like how we think about Seinfeld episodes. Like, all you have to do, right?
Right.
All you have to do is say soup Nazi.
Parentals, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we all know.
Yeah.
Like, something in here makes me also think that, like, they could just say... Lo Tirsach, give it a code, and everybody knows where they're going.
Yeah, yeah.
But we've lost that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now we're trying to decipher, well, what did they really mean? Mm. Was it for him? Was it for everyone? But, like, they knew.
Yeah.
You didn't have to provide that explanation.
Yeah, good. This is another kind of response to Avi's question earlier. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I want to go back to the idea of these are, like, his notes in the margins.
Right,
of the Torah.
Right.
Like, I'm remembering. And then could you extrapolate from that and say, well, maybe Rashi's were just his own.
Right.
Yeah.
Because Rashi's big thing was the commentary on the Talmud.
Uh-huh.
Right? So this is his. And, like, uh-huh. I know it kind of pulls.
Yeah, I think.
The thing you love to do with your time, which is to explore these.
Yeah. I think, in general, on the Midrashic end of Torah commentary, we can always be asking this kind of big, you know, for Chazal themselves, do they mean it? When these midrashim, are they always serious about it? Or is it a way of giving some color and flavor to a connection that's being identified?
What we are doing is we're trying to study their notes.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, if I, you know, if you studied somebody, if there was a lecture in university and you took some student's notes and you started studying their notes,
right?
You wouldn't. You're trying to read.
What you're saying is especially sort of potent when we think about people like the Balaturim and Rashi, who seem to be trying to use as few words as possible.
Right.
That's a particular mode, and the Ramban, for example, is not hewing to that mode. So that's just an interesting. Okay. Oh, do you want to?
But he said at the very outset, these are parparot.
Right? Right.
These are, like, I think of this as almost like going to a tapas bar.
Uh-huh.
Like that in a sense, like he's the tapas commentator.
Yeah.
That he's giving you, you know, it's a taste of this, and a taste of that. Do they relate to one another? Okay.
But I think we're getting a little too dismissive of the Balaturim here. Let me now take you to this is like a famous Balaturim. This is like a Chiddush that we often associate with the Balaturim. I actually, part of the reason that I brought it here is that I'm not sure whether it has an earlier source or the Balaturim said it first. I'm not sure. If someone can find an earlier source, I'd be grateful for it. But I think this might be the Balaturim's Chiddush, and it's usually cited as such. So let's take a look here. This is for Parsha Tetzaveh. And I bet you've heard this drasha before, but you might not have known that it comes from the Balaturim. All right, where are we in our circle? Okay, please, will you read and Moses never mentioned.
Moses is never mentioned by name in this portion, whereas he's mentioned in every parasha since he was born for the rest of the Torah until Deuteronomy. The reason is that he said to God, erase me from your book. And even though Moses had only said this conditionally, the curse of a sage, even if uttered conditionally, is fulfilled.
Okay. Lo hizkir kan Moshe b'shem, al shem, ma she'ein kein b'chol ha'chumash. He says b'chol ha'chumash, but it's also true in Devarim. Shemishah she'nolad Moshe ein seder shelo huzkarba. V'hatam mishum she'amar macheni na misifrecha. Ki klalat chacham afilu al tanai hiba'a. Okay, and then there's another interpretation offered.
Other commentators say it was because this is about the clothing of the high priest of Aaron, and originally Moses himself had been slated to be the high priest. So mentioning his name while talking about the clothing might have caused him anguish, for they were originally meant for him and then were taken away from him.
Okay, very different reason, interesting. V'yesh mefarshim, and I wonder who these mefarshim are, l'fi sheratza l'tzavot al inyan habegadim, Le'aron, u'moshe atid liyot kohen gadol, v'hayalo agimat nefesh, lahazkiro etzel abgadim, shayu roim lo, v'nilkachu mimenu. Okay. All right, so what's the Baal HaTorim's big chiddush here? And I'm not sure it's his, but his big chiddush.
His name isn't included because the were meant for Moses.
Wait, before, okay, that's good. Before the interpretation, you already said it. Moshe's name is not mentioned in Parsha Tetzaveh.
That's his chiddush?
That's his chiddush.
It was from him?
Well, that's what I think, okay.
Like his awareness.
I will tell you that when I like looked this up and there was a translation, it had in parentheses Zohar Chadash. Okay. In the Zohar Chadash, it says that. Now, the Zohar Chadash, who knows how old the Zohar Chadash is, but it was printed for the first time after the Baal. I don't know what he's drawing from here and whether it's his chiddush or not, but I don't know of a classical midrash that mentions this particular insight that, but maybe you can find one for me. I looked it up.
Are you suggesting that it took until the 13th century?
To figure out, well, it's a funny thing.
That there's one parsha that doesn't mention.
Well, but it's a funny thing because it's not really, it's a weird little observation. It's like, since Moshe was born, meaning starting at Shemot, so Bereshit obviously does not mention Moshe, and you know, I have it here in brackets, but I don't think that it's in his, I don't know if he missed this, but in Parsha, you know, Re'eh, Moshe's name is not Mer, Parsha Kitavo, Moshe's, there's a series in the middle of Devarim where Moshe's name is not mentioned because he's speaking. So what you're saying is basically in Shmot, Vayikra, and Bamidbar, this is the only Parsha that doesn't have Moshe mentioned by name. That's an interesting thing to like, yeah. Be able to observe, produce, and then to come up with like explanations for it is second layer. Like maybe Moshe wanted to have himself blotted out. Maybe that's why he doesn't appear. Or maybe the opposite. It's like it's not a punishment. It's a we feel bad for Moshe. Both of these are very like beautiful interpretations, but all rest on this idea that I think originates with the Baal HaTorim that this is the parsha that Moshe is absent from. And it's an interesting parsha because the first word of the parsha is Vata, you. Like God is talking to Moshe in sort of a very prominent way, and yet Moshe's name never appears. There is something a little haunting about that.
Again and again.
Right, ata, ata, ata. Right, you're right. And there's a few of those in the beginning. Yeah, Sarah.
He says that other people explain it.
Yeah, you're right.
It must be that it's someone else's.
It must be. Yeah, must be. It must be. And to say.
But we can give it.
Yeah. To say that it's in the Zohar Chadash, like I said, I don't know if he read the Zohar Chadash, but it also means like it's like. You know, what the Zohar, like, does is collect lots of, you know, midrashic understandings of the Torah, midrashic / mystical understandings of the Torah. So maybe it's just a tradition that's out there. Yeah. Yesh mefar. I like, wondered, is there anything else that v'yesh v'yud mem could mean? But I think it's a reference to other commentators, so. Okay. So that's, like, that's an example of a Baal HaTorim that has a lot of legs. You will hear, I feel like, every third drasha on Parsha Tetzaveh is about how Moshe doesn't appear at all in this parsha. Well, the Baal HaTorim's eagle eye is the one that perhaps cited that first. Okay. These are playful, and I know we're doing a lot of chuckling. But actually, to begin to take the Baal HaTorim a little more seriously, the thing that I have learned from him the most, the thing that I have been awed by the Baal HaTorim the most, is a particular move that is one of his most common moves. Not gematria, and not these sort of unusual sort of observations, but it was something he does very, very often, which is to say, Beit b'mesora, Gimel b'mesora, Dalet b'mesora. The word is b'mesora, and what that means in the tradition, and what he means by that is this particular word appears in the Mesorah, in Tanakh, two times, or three times, or four times. And when he does that, he doesn't just mean like, oh, this word form appears three times, or this root word appears three times, but the actual form with a lamed in front appears only three times, or a vav in front, or chem at the end of it, whatever it is, whatever form of the word. So this really is a testament to the Balei Torah's, like, you know, I said savant-like, kind of computer mind, where he's just seeing connections in the way that the Midrash does, but it's like he has the power of Midrash in him. Like, he can just find connections in this really... Well, let's take an example, because what ends up happening when he does that is that he's building the entirely new Midrashim. So here's a good example of, like, something I don't think this appears in any other source. This is a beautiful, like, Midrash that is constructed by the keen eye of the Balei Torah.
Judah took her for a prostitute. The word appears twice in Tanakh, here and in Isaiah. How has she become like a prostitute? Is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Just as Tamar was disgraced and in the end was glorified, so will Jerusalem come in the end to glory, as it says in Zechariah, it will be glory in it. And that is what it means in Shir Shirim, your stately form for your rise is like a
wow.
All right? Wow. Okay.
It goes back to the Tamar thing.
Beit b'mesora v'yachsheveha lazona.
Yeah.
He eicha haita lazona. Okay, which is to say the Balei Torah realized, understood, has a memory that allows him to say, zona, zonot, this word appears at different times in Tanakh, but lizona, that particular phrasing only appears in the Tamar and Yehuda story and in the book and in Isaiah when describing the destruction of Jerusalem. That's already, you could have just stopped there. That's it. That's a connection you see all the time in the Balei Torah, is like Beit b'mesorah here and there, or three times here and there. And then just like you have a drusha waiting for you, rabbis, like this is a rabbi's gathering. Like, you take it and make something of it. Like, what is the connection then between the Tamar and Yehuda story and the destruction of Jerusalem story? That's usually all he gives you, but in this case, he goes further. Now, it's just remarkable. Ma Tamar bebizayon ulebasof bechavod af Yerushalayim sofa bechavod dechtiv ulechavod eheye betocha. I don't know why he needs to quote Zechariah. I haven't made a special connection there. But yes, it's Jerusalem again, and glory will be back to it. So glory will be for Tamar as well. And then this last thing is just crazy. V'zeo zot komatech damta l'Tamar. Your stately, it's just a poetic line in Shir HaShirim, but he turns it into your rise once again, komatech, your rise, will be like Tamar's rise, who went from Bizayon to Chavod. Right. I mean, come on! Yeah.
I think there's an addendum to that.
Yeah.
Sadika Tamar Yifrah.
Yeah, very nice. You see what we can do with the Balei Torah on our side? Yeah.
I think you're climbing up the wrong tree.
I understand this might be a projection onto him, but like, I want to read that there's something that feels like feminist about this to me.
Yeah.
It's like this word, Lizona.
Mm-hmm.
It's like using women with this metaphor that is kind of like degrading metaphor for women.
Yeah.
When you see Lizona, actually don't associate it with a degrading metaphor for women. Actually, you should associate it with Chavod. And also, this I feel like I'm sort of really overly reading into it, but I even appreciate when he says, Yerushalayim sofa bechavod, he could have said, like, Hatchala Lizona, like Lizona.
Right.
He's like, I'm not even going to say that. We're
right.
Not going to focus on the Zona part. We're going to focus on
right.
But it's like, now I get to have this other association.
Yeah.
That's not about using this metaphor that's degrading.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I just want, like, just to build on what you're on that observation. There's something about, like, the word itself, like v'yachshevel zona, like he thought, like it's such a disgraceful word, and it's like Tamar, she's our ancestor, and like she obviously she's like, you know, dressing up to be one, but it's like that word sort of falls on her, and it's like it's a marking, you know, a scarlet letter. And then he realizes, like, that very word, like, that form of that word falls only on one other, entity, and it's Yerushalayim, our beloved Yerushalayim. Like, that it's like it redeems the word choice, the original word choice, right? Like, I mean, yeah.
It's also suggesting that no word is, you know, every word is intentional.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And here, okay, and here, if you're going to make that kind, are we still in the realm of just sort of like memory associations? Maybe, or maybe he's saying like, no, these verses taken together create a message. There's a message here. Like that last line from Shir HaShirim, he just like, oh, and I got a cool one for you here. Or does he think, no, like Tamar is a symbol of this movement from Bizayon to Kavod. And we should take that very seriously because that movement is fundamental to like our, you know, journey through history. Yes.
Well, I think it like speaks to the multi-mission statement of his introduction, which is like, I'm going to make Ramban more palatable. I'm going to do this for my own learning.
Yeah.
I'm going to help you with things that are really difficult. And I'm going to throw in some spicy stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I think like it makes sense. There's not like a cohesive experience of his teaching.
Yeah.
Because he already sets out in his mission that he's planning to do a whole lot.
Right.
Sometimes even contradictory things.
Yes, yes. That's well said. That's well said.
Like, yeah. Okay, here's this like place which feels almost like an anthology showing you the simplicity but also depth of just the word creation.
Yeah.
So like here's this like much more like text rich things that I put together. It's like kind of reading his notebook.
Yeah.
Does he ever get it wrong?
What do you mean? What? You mean the Bamasora thing? I don't know. I always wonder about that because he does it all the time. It's like, I'd have to be holding enough to know, but yes. Yeah, I probably could. Okay, AI will do that for us. One day, next year actually, AI will just be teaching the class. I won't even be here. Okay, so here we are. So I think we have now a good appreciation for the Balaturium, his style, what he's capable of. Now, just for our last act here, which I've called Curious Cases, I want to just note that all of this is the delight of the Balaturium, the sort of like the wonder of learning the Balaturium, the awe, you know, by the end of seeing the kinds of connections that he can make. But the Balaturium is so playful that every once in a while, I reading the Balaturium, my attention is caught by something that seems like bizarre, like he couldn't have just said that. And so here's another layer to the Balaturium, like not just the connections he makes, but some of the strange things he says. It almost gives you, I guess I start to get the feeling that he's like, he is actually messing with you a little bit. He actually is like being a little frisky, I guess is the word. Okay, so let's take a look here at what I mean. This is his commentary on when Avram came back to eulogize Sarah and to cry over Ulif Kota, to cry over Sarah. And in that word, when Abraham at the beginning of Chaya Sarah comes to cry over Sarah, the kaf in to cry over Ulivachta is small by Masoretic tradition. And remember, he said Gematriot and Tameim Hamisorot. He loves Otiot Mishunot, like big letters, small letters, broken letters, twisty letters, anything. That's fair game for his interpretive process. So that's just cool in itself. But so you'll see him do that, is interpret. He's the go-to if you have a big or a small letter. Look at the Balaturium, he'll probably say something about it. But in this case, what he says is strange. It's very strange. And I want to just sort of consider that he might be saying it kind of dafka, like almost to startle us, okay? So let's take a look at what he says here.
Okay, and to cry for her. The small cough signifies that Abraham cried, but not too much, because she was already elderly. Alternatively, because she caused her own death when what? She passed judgment for her own deeds unto another, and therefore was punished first. I don't know that.
Yeah, we'll soon look this up, and we'll try to make sense of it.
One does not eulogize someone who intentionally commits suicide.
Ooh. Weird stuff, but it's weird. Okay, so first of all, she was already so old he didn't cry that much. I heard people say, like, that's not nice. But there's some logic to, like, oh, she had died in a ripe old age. It wasn't as big a tragedy.
We get that as rabbis all the time. Like, people are like, you know, it's, oh, it was their time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I heard another ooh.
Married, you know.
And then, of course, I heard another ooh at the end, like, oh, like, you, there you are knocking someone who committed suicide. Though we have all of those halachot out there, that there are all kinds of adjustments to mourning practices around suicide. But why does he go here? Why does he suggest that Sarah committed suicide? Well, he says he got it from the Talmud.
Right.
Okay, let's go take a look at the Talmud that presumably this story is from.
Rabbi Avin said, anyone who passes a case against another to God is punished first, as it is stated, and Sarai said to Avram, my anger be upon you. I have given my maid into your bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. Let the Lord judge between me and you. And it is written afterward, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her.
Okay. De'amar Rabbi Avin, kol ha-moser din al chavero, hu ne'enash tchila. Shneamar, v'tomer Sarai el Avram, chamasi alecha, uchtiv, v'yavo Avram lispod l'sar v'liv kota. Okay. We do have a connection to that verse. So Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. But it's different here. Like, what is it? What is the idea here that the Talmud is giving us?
Karma.
Karma. Yeah, like if you tried to get someone else punished, you get punished first.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that explains...
Suicide?
Yeah, that's like very weird. Suicide. And I know we even say now, we don't usually say commit suicide. The more polite way to say it is died by suicide. But I use the language of commit here because I want you to feel that he's being kind of savage here. And I don't know exactly what abed atzmo ledat ein maspidin oto. It's such a weird thing to call Sarah, saying that Abraham's punishment should be on him, her committing suicide. It's just a weird. This is the first example I want to give you of like, where did he get that from? Like, why did he go in that direction? He has the Talmud on his side, but it's like it wasn't the language the Talmud used. So like. For him to get, I don't know, like, bold in that way is very strange, yeah.
So I've heard several midrashim about her committing suicide, but it has to do with Hasatan and him luring her
right.
and jumps off a cliff
right.
Because she's so upset
right.
about what Abraham did.
Right.
But I don't know how that ties into
But that's very helpful. So because that actually might be part of, I'm sort of wondering, how could he go there here? But... the midrashim that you're citing, I know one that says like the Satan told her and her heart stopped, but yeah, like if there are midrashim that have her jumping off a cliff, well, now you can see he's like, what he's doing actually is like gathering together, like synthesizing, putting these things together and calling it suicide, perhaps with some midrashic encouragement. So yeah.
The Eish Kodesh also kind of seems to suggest that she committed suicide,
uh-huh.
but like he does it by way of saying she deliberately died, like allowed her grief to overwhelm her such that she died for our sake to make a point to God to
mm-hmm.
show that sometimes it's too much. But it's like, that's interesting because it's like, he could have also been
yeah.
kind of dealing with it. Yeah, there are right. these yeah. pre-existing midrashim that are suggesting that she committed suicide and that's uncomfortable
yeah.
for him, and so he is finding a different way to talk about it.
Yeah. Yes, but the way he's talking about it is so sort of abrupt and
yeah.
kind of like brutal. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like all the midrashim you're citing, as you suggest, have this very like, or maybe it's the Eish Kodesh in this case, but it's a sense of like, she was in mourning and tragedy, and she's sort of, you know, like, it's a terrible tragedy. This is like, well, that's what you get for committing suicide. It's like very strange tone here, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, the beginning of this, actually his commentary, not the Talmud piece, it's a little bit evocative. It reminds me of the beginning one that we studied of the Devar Acher, Devar Acher. Like, in other
mm-hmm.
words, here's this one, here's this comment. Small calf, she was old.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, like, it's a Devar Acher. And there's an... you say, like, he's a bit of a savant
mm-hmm.
in the text.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if he, like, I'm reading way too much, but if there's some neurodivergency
mm-hmm.
here.
Oh, that's very speculative, but interesting.
Very speculative, but in the sense that, like, somebody who's on the spectrum, right,
would
be like, I'm just going to tell you everything.
Yeah, right? Interesting.
Or I'm going to give you this commentary, not without a sense of empathy of
Right.
Filter.
And there's no filter, and that's what I mean by like.
Yeah, it's hard to diagnose. Right. But I will say that, like, you're right in the sense that part of what I'm wondering is like, who was this guy? What was his personality? What was he like willing to say and not say? There's some interesting questions there.
Saying stuff that you might not like in a cocktail. In party.
Yeah, yeah, pup like company.
Wait for two things. One, he doesn't cite those midrashim where she commits suicide, where she's
right.
supposed to have committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
He could have done that, and I'm sure he knew them if he knows all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And two, using the word moser din is pretty strong language.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about mosrim as it develops over Jewish historical
right.
experience.
Giving him over. Right.
You know, Vela Mal Shinim was
right.
one
yeah.
mosrim.
Right, but what's weird is even if we accept all of that and the severity of her crime, it's still strange to call what she. I put Avram. I threw him under the bus, and in doing so, knowingly took my own life. Like that's a weird second step to make there. Yeah.
Isn't it at all possible to translate it as like deliberately? Acts self-destructively. Acts in destroys oneself.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That, I guess, sort must of understand. It's like, do you call on God and say, choose between me and Abraham? That seems like a pretty self-destructive choice for someone to make.
Yeah.
And as a result, she was ultimately
yeah.
God chose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's fair. And I've obviously been somewhat provocative in my translation here. I remember reading it and being like, whoa, that is so weird. Did he just say that? But yes, I do hear what you're saying.
Also, you could close the loop way quicker by saying, the reason Abraham only cried a little bit is because she threw him under the bus. He purposefully adds.
Like, yeah.
Much more like theological
yeah.
Steps in between. Like,
yeah.
So I guess it's like, there's something very deliberate about adding in that extra yeah. step where God is placed in between that interpersonal relationship.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Human's reaction,
right.
something another human did, like to the human's reaction in relation to
yeah.
their relationship with their human partner,
yeah.
somehow ends up in this like
he
divine
likes,
nexus. It's like it's very purposeful.
Yeah, yeah,
he likes Tamar. He doesn't like Sarah.
Yeah, clearly not. But yeah, I mean, I'm left to wonder. Is he communicating as he is in all the other, like a kind of message to us that like, does he want us to be startled? Or is it more like you're suggesting like there's just something compulsive, he has to bring every possible interpretation he can think of and maybe kind of, you know, condense them into one little thing. Okay, so this is one example. Here comes another one, a little more straightforward, less to like wonder about, but certainly startling also from a medieval commentator. So check this one out. This is from Devarim. Let's see, where are we? Stephen, here, I'll read the Hebrew and then you read the English. This is from the Psukim in Devarim. Ki yikach ish isha chadasha, lo yetze b'tzava, v'lo yavor alav l'chol davar, naki yeh leveito, shana achat, v'simach et ishto asher lakach.
When a man has taken a bride, he shall not go out with the army or be assigned to it for any purpose. He shall be exempt for 1 year for the sake of his household to give happiness to the woman he has married.
Okay, next pasuk. Lo yachbol rechayim v'rechev ki nefesh hu chovel.
He must not take in pawn a handmill or a millstone, for that would be taking someone's life in pawn.
Okay, new law, new thought, fine. Here comes the balaturim. Lo yachbol rechayim v'rechev mikra katsar hu. Uferusho lo yachbol achovel. Will you read that for us?
This is an abbreviated verse, for it fails to tell us who the subject is. It is the creditor who, after the loan is overdue, wants to secure his loan with some collateral.
Okay, and the language is a chovel. The creditor, chovel, will be yachbol. Ve'al derech hadrash asi shapir shechozer al lemala v'simach et ishto. Lo yachbol v'gomer. Perush lo yimashken b'tashmish limon omimena. Kmo vayihi hu tochen.
Whoa.
I'm blushing already. But by way
Whoa.
Of drash, the words flow better because it refers back above to the directive for the newlywed husband to devote himself to making his bride happy. Do not take this in pawn. Meaning, do not withhold sex from her as collateral,
as if he was just grinding.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely not PG stuff here. But it's, okay, so a lot of interesting things about that, about this. First of all, the phrase that he begins with, Va'al derech drash asi shapir, this works better through a drash. The verse itself is missing a word. Whatever, just assume that the subject is the chovel. Just assume that. But to tell you the truth, it's almost like I prefer this. It works better to see this omission as a reference back to above. Okay, so that's just interesting. Like, what does he mean, Val derech drash asi shapir? Does that tell us something about... It's an interesting move here, in part because Rechaim and Rechem are potentially connected. He may be building on that, Rechem womb and Rechaim. And then that last thing, Vayhi hu tochen, that's like a weird... I don't know exactly how to translate that. Do not withhold sex for her, as if he was just grinding, as if... I'm not sure exact. Now, a millstone grinds, right? So that's part of the reference. But I think that this is a reference to the Shimshon story where they bring him to Gaza and they shackle him. He becomes a slave in the prison. And Vayhi tochin bevet ha'asurim. He would grind in the prison house. The midrash there, I just happen to know because I taught Shoftim last summer, says he was grinding, meaning they would make him perform sexually. But he was like, but it was a torture. He would just be forced to perform sexually. So I think that's the reference that he's making. It's just like grinding, even though it's also a reference to the millstone. There's like a lot going on in here, but it's like a very, you know, X-ray, weird X-rated like Balaturim here. That's like. I don't know. Like, I don't know quite what to do, but again, I was startled by it, yeah.
We were saying this text also feels like it reads as feminist, and it also feels like there's even, just having read the Tamar text, in which, like, there's also a sex incident withholding sex,
yeah.
Lifting Tamar up at the end of it. And I wonder, like, is it random that you brought us these two? How coincidental is it that you brought us these two?
Mm.
With your sort of knowledge of it, is this a trend that exists beyond...
Yeah, you know, this it may say more about me, the collector, than it does about the Balaturim, because I think that is, these are the ones that I noticed and put together. I mean, let me just say this, when I was like, you know, Googling and AIing, I came upon this one, like others I had seen just in my survey of the Balaturim, but this was sort of flagged as here's a wild thing the Balaturim says, so that like came in, that's evidence for the like, no, he's got something with women, sexuality, something. I mean, the very fact that he writes this, but it also could be that I have something that I'm like interested in these issues. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Family life, was he married? Did he have kids? Do you know that?
Yeah, I mean he was married and had kids. I don't know much about it though.
Talking about that with the Sarah piece, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we are one last move, okay? I hope both of these startle you in different ways. That sort of I'm left wondering who is this guy? I don't have like anything brilliant to say about it, but that it is rather startling.
Again, no filter.
Yeah, no filter. Okay, here's a last fun and curious case, which requires a little bit of later commentaries to make sense of. Okay, so let's see if we in this case, I'm not even sure. Let me say at the outset, I'm not even sure exactly what the Balaturim is saying, okay? There has been speculation on this commentary. So here in Devarim, we're worried about false prophets, if there should rise a false prophet among you, okay? Ki yakum bikirbecha navi o cholem chalom v'natan alecha ot o mofet. Will you read for us?
If there arises in your midst a prophet or a dreamer who gives you a sign or a wonder...
Okay, and then the Balaturim says, "Ki yakum b'kirbecha, b'kirbecha b'gematria zo ha'isha."
There arise in your midst b'kirbecha has the gematria of this is the woman.
Okay, and here it is, women issues again, right?
But I think is this also feminist in the sense it's like, well, there might be a woman who is charismatic enough that you would think to follow her like a nippy, but also she too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there could be something about
her.
She's
a witch.
When gets up, then you know it's fake.
Yeah.
Right.
Kirbecha, that everybody comes born from a woman.
Right. Well, that certainly is the association with the woman, is that it's you know, inside of you. And that's the, okay, here's where it gets weird. That's the connect. So who is he talking about here? He's talking probably about some false prophet who is a woman, right?
I believe that there were actually a number in this, in these centuries, there were a number of women, certainly within Christianity, and I think I remember, somebody else may recall, in Judaism, who claimed to be able to speak from God or had some messianic. I mean, certainly, I'm going to see if I can look this up.
Yeah,
I mean,
interesting.
I don't think this is on, this was an issue, I think, within Christianity.
Yeah, the witches they endure.
Okay, okay, here's the last move that I want you to see here. Okay, now, this, we see that he's drawing very often from earlier Midrashic sources. Here's a very early Midrashic source, the Sifrei Devarim. Bikirbecha, the Sifrei says, Lerabot et Haisha. This is to include the woman, or a woman, which fits very well into the interpretation that Avi just sort of unpacked for us. Like, it includes a woman also, okay? The language he uses is different. Zo Haisha, this is the woman. But then again, he's trying to get to the right gematria, right? So he has to use that language. However, there has subsequently been some very interesting speculation on why he might have seized on this particular midrash and turned it into a gematria. And take a look at, this is Eliyahu Monk. If you have gone to a Jewish bookstore, you've seen Eliyahu Monk because he's translated like just every Torah commentary on earth. That is like the sketch he's been sitting writing his entire life. So he translated the tour. Take a look at what he says in a footnote on this comment. There is a bracket by the publisher in my edition that calls attention to a gematria our author left out of his commentary. Navi, prophet, are shown to have the same numerical value as the word Uvana and her son. Okay? And here it is in, here's what it is. I am begamatria shall rabbeinu amechaber vechaser sham Navi begamatria Uvana. So the comment is missing, in which case Bikirbecha zo haisha, in your midst or inside of you, that's the woman. Navi is the next word, and the gematria of that is uvana. This is the woman and her son. Inside of you, from inside of you, a Navi will arise. This is the woman and her son. It's Jesus! Or is it?
I don't know.
So let's just finish this. The author did publish the other half of this, i.e. that the word Bikirbecha is equivalent in numerical value to the word Zoisha, this is the woman, i.e. the woman experiencing the Immaculate Conception who gave birth, this is Eliyahu Monk, who gave birth to the founder of Christianity who was halachically a Jew, Bikirbecha. Clearly, the author, living as he did in Christian Spain in the 14th century where the Inquisition held sway, did not want to expose himself to the accusation by the Inquisition that he had labeled that man as a false prophet. Chumash editions printed in predominantly Christian countries either omit the author's comment on this verse altogether or to present it in an entirely unintelligible form. Just that the value of the numerical Bikirbecha has the numerical value of the word Zoisha. Okay, so interesting. Like, it does make it a much cooler comment if you say Zoe Sha Uvana, right? Like, now he's really, because otherwise, why did he turn the inclusion of a woman into, like, it's such a random snippet, not random, right? Like, but it's a snippet in the Sifrei. Why does he have to bring it here? But if he did both of those things, that would be really saying something. But here's the Birkat Asher, who's just like a modern commentator, who discusses this, Leaniut Dati Ein Ze Mistaber. In my humble opinion, it is unreasonable to assume that the Balaturim tried to find a hint here in the Torah referring to that man. Yeah, man. It's funny that he ends that way by the Lo'oto Ha'ish, just like the Yimach Shemo, right, Yimach Shemo. That man, just like the, and the Balaturim was the one who said that woman, or that is the woman. There's just something interesting here. I don't know. What do you think? There's a debate. Did the Balaturim really do this? You've now gotten to know the Balaturim a little bit. Do you think that he probably did the gematria with Zoe Sha Uvana?
Yes.
Or do you think this is all? Yes, definitely. I love this. Oh, more, not
smart. And then you see like the politics, you know, between Monk and you know, how do you pronounce his name? Wasser Thiel?
Yeah, he is a 20th century Israeli educator who wrote Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata.
Okay. He left a lot of room for interpretation.
Oh, stop. Wait, but finish your thought, please.
I was going to say, like, the fact that he hinted in the Torah, he's that man, that he writing now in Israel, you can't even use the term.
Right, exactly. Ironically, the Birkat Asher is echoing the discourse of, you know, that man that I will not mention, that woman and her son. So that's interesting. And what were you going to suggest?
First of all, I think that there should be a like mockumentary made about the tour. Based on just this piece.
Who's going to play the tour?
Exactly. But I also feel like this could also be about Samuel.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We have Hannah as this like huge character,
right,
of prayer and, you know, pseudo Nevi'ah.
Uh-huh.
And then Nevuah, excuse me. And then we get Samuel, this who is a legit prophet. So I don't know.
But the problem is that the problem is this verse is condemning a false prophet. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's
14th century Spain.
It is 14th century Spain.
So, I think that really leans on a thing. Potentially real.
Yeah. 14th century. We haven't yet hit the Inquisition.
Oh, no, but it started. It's bad.
Here's the thing. The gematria bikirbecha zohai isha. It's a cool way to bring in the sifrei, but it just sort of seems like a strange thing to suddenly include as a gematria that you, in your little parperaot ha-chokhmah, want to add, you know, oh, look, I can stick the sifrei into here. But zoa isha uvena, if that's true, that's like classic Balaturim, right? So I don't know, but I think what we're left with is two possibilities. Either the Balaturim has this, like, you know, we've already seen him be subtle and bold and, you know, between the lines. Either he has this remarkable, you know, insertion of a gematria that's meant to condemn the founder of Christianity buried in some, you know, side manuscripts of his commentary. Or, no, he never meant to do this at all. But there's just something about the Balaturim that causes the rest of us to speculate somebody else came up with the idea. Oh, you can just tack on Uvana to the next word. Like, either he did it or he prompted someone to come up with this brilliant gematria. So, you know, it's like the treasures that are in the Balaturim and also the treasures that the Balaturim encourages us to go out and discover. And I think that's one of the takeaways that I have with the Balaturim is that he's encouraging us to make wonder of the Torah, to look for clues in the Torah, to go searching, infinitely searching into the language of the Torah. Because it's right, as he said, Lo b'shamayim, it's right, not across the sea, it's right there in front of you. Just play with the words a little and you never know what will come out. So,
yeah.
Thanks everyone. Thanks for joining me for this. This was fun. Really fun.